advised by cynical consultants determined to hide the president's senility by misdirection. Not at all. Their love is as real as climate change.
A little nuts? Well, maybe. But unlike the moon landing or a 44-year marriage, you can't fake ratings like this. And while, yes, at least one person did sue for defamation, a judge dismissed the case on the grounds that any reasonable viewer knows that even things Tucker says are facts are not actual facts. So whatever the future holds for him, one thing we know is that Tucker, Severus, McFly, Carlson will do it with a smile. Or whatever's going on there.
So we've got new hairstyles and maternity flight suits. Pregnant women are going to fight our wars. It's a mockery of the U.S. military. While China's military becomes more masculine as it's assembled the world's largest navy, our military needs to become, as Joe Biden says, more feminine. Whatever feminine means anymore, since men and women no longer exist.
What are you talking about, you performatively outraged wedge salad? Now, he's packed a lot in there, from transphobia to weirdly extolling the masculinity of China's Navy to his completely misplaced outrage at Joe Biden over those flight suits, which were part of an initiative that started when Trump was president and also included ensuring that body armor actually fits women service members, which is obviously a good idea. Those comments sparked an all too familiar cycle of condemnation, defensiveness, and hype. And it seems like every week now, Tucker has another one of these mini controversies. Last week, it was the Dr. Seuss bull. And look, I would like nothing more than to not play into his wildly offensive shtick. You might even be thinking right now, why give him the attention that he's so clearly trolling for? But the fact is, we're not giving Tucker any attention he's not already getting a lot of. The night he made those flight suit remarks, he was the most watched show on cable. He averages over 3 million views a night and does well in the key 25 to 54 demo, meaning that young people are watching him, as well as the normal Fox audience of retirees and their sad imprisoned pets. He is so important to the network that they are expanding Tucker's presence, launching a new video podcast and long-form documentary series. And if that wasn't enough, Tucker's also been floated as a potential future presidential candidate, which should be seriously alarming because of all the things that Tucker is, a conspiracy theorist, a misogynist, Islamophobe, a troll, one of the most dangerous is that he is the most prominent vessel in America for white supremacist talking points. And I already know what Tucker will say about this because whenever this topic comes up, he has the exact same reaction. What does that even mean?
White nationalism. Let's be literal for a minute. What is that exactly?
I don't even know what white nationalism means, and I'm not going to go down that rabbit hole with you now.
Why doesn't anyone ever define white supremacy? What is white supremacy?
Can somebody tell us in very clear language what a white supremacist is? This show was not on the air for 6 months before there was an organized and highly aggressive campaign by prominent Democrats to denounce us as white supremacists. The first time it happened, the people who work on this show, many of them kids, were shocked and horrified by that. White supremacists? What's worse than that? The phrase evokes images of burning crosses and lynchings. It's awful.
Okay, first, I'm so sorry, Tucker. I honestly didn't realize that your show was staffed entirely by children. I certainly never intended for them to get caught up in all of this, so my sincere apologies, you tiny little rascals. But I don't burn crosses or lynch people, so I can't be a white supremacist is a pretty weak argument. It's like saying I can't be an anti-Semite because I didn't do the Holocaust, or I can't be a sexual predator because I didn't produce Good Will Hunting. There is more than one way to be a terrible person. And Tucker, conveniently for him, doesn't fit neatly into a lot of people's perception of white supremacists, especially if they share his definition that it must require burning crosses, Klan hoods, and a name tag that says, hello, my name is a racist. But for the record, white supremacists themselves seem to be big fans of what Tucker's been doing. Just listen to Derek Black, a former white supremacist whose father started Stormfront, the largest, oldest white supremacist site on the internet, talk about just how much his family likes Tucker's show.
My family watches Tucker Carlson's show once and then watches it on the replay because they feel that he is making the white nationalist talking points better than they have. And they're trying to get some tips on how to advance it.
Yeah. They watch it once to enjoy it and a second time to learn from it. So given that Tucker has the admiration of white supremacists and the ear of millions of your relatives, co-workers, and elected officials, we thought tonight it would be worth talking about him.
Let me ask you, Mr. Carlson, do you think we're honest with each other race to race?
Oh, no, of course not. I mean, you know, everybody is terrified of one thing. You know, whites are, of course, terrified of being called a racist. Blacks are terrified of being belittled, of course. I think we need actually probably less conversation about race. I think it might do us good were we to ignore the subject a little bit and treat each other as if there were no color boundary separating us. I think that might be helpful. I think we talk about it in some ways too much.
I'm pretty sure that black people are less terrified of being belittled than of being killed, jailed, economically exploited, or indeed denied access to healthcare after their heads literally explode from hearing someone in a bow tie and plaid blazer suggest being called racist is as bad as actually experiencing racism.
I mean, Pat does raise issues that I think are important. Unfortunately, Pat Buchanan raises them in a way that I think is discredited. And when attacked, he can always fall back on the line, well, the tiny cabal that controls American politics doesn't like me because I speak truth to power. This is actually, incidentally, almost verbatim what he said the other day, that I offend the plutocracy, that I'm a wanted man by the inside the beltway people, and in every sense cast himself as a victim who is sort of a Karen Silkwood of politics, someone who's so truthful that he's being hunted down by the conspiracy that runs Washington. I mean, it's all a bit much.
How did you go from criticizing Pat Buchanan for that precise tactic to basically imitating him? It's all, to borrow a phrase, a bit much.
The problem is there are many of us here who do like this country. We live here. We don't want to destroy it. We have every right to fight to preserve our nation and our heritage and our culture.
Wow. Preserve our heritage and culture. That is direct. In fact, his pre-written caption there, "We have to fight to preserve our nation and heritage," drew a lot of comparisons to the 14 words, the famous white supremacist slogan that says, "We must secure the existence of our people and a future for white children." And when you put the two together, there is, a slight similarity there. I'm just saying, if you typed Tucker's quote into a blank Word document, 9 times out of 10, Clippy's going to ask, are you trying to recite the 14 words?
Let me just stipulate, I'm for getting along, I'm for colorblindness, I'm for tolerance, 100%. But I also think that if things radically change in your country, it's okay for you to say, what is this? And maybe I don't want to live in a country that looks nothing like the country I grew up in. Is that bigoted?
Yeah. Yeah, it is. That's like saying, I've got 10 fingers and toes, a pointy face with a little pink rosebud mouth, a cat-sized body, a long weird tail, and I eat garbage. Does that make me a possum? Yes. Yes, it does. That's the literal definition of the thing you just described. But when you put all of this together, the pattern is clear. He is scared of a country that looks nothing like the one he grew up in because diversity isn't our strength. Immigrants make our country poorer, dirtier, and more divided, and any attempt to change that culture is an attack on Western civilization. All of which is really just a long way of saying that when Tucker asks, what is white supremacy? The answer is basically that. It's a belief that in a country where white people are dominant, that's all down to their natural and innate abilities, and any effort to change that is an affront to the natural order of things.
Fido, your leash is too long. You go where you don't belong. You've been digging in the rubble, getting bitches in trouble. Fido, your leash is too long. Fido, your leash is too long. I don't know where I went wrong. You scare me out of my wits when you do that shit. So Fido, your leash is too long. Fido, you gone far enough. I must have all of your love. You just run out of luck. I don't care what you fuck sounds do, but your leash is too long. Fido, your leash is too long.
preceding show was recorded at Wave Farms WGXC in the Hudson Valley in New York State.
For some reason or another, you sound a little taller on radio.
WGXC underwriting support has been provided by Dedicated Presentation Solutions. Allow DPS to turn your audiovisual how-do-eyes into here's-how-you-cans. Visit dedicatedpresentation.com or call 845-475-8465 for more information. Dedicated Presentation Solutions, your audiovisual partner.
We're talking with Raya Salter, who is an attorney. She's the policy director for the New York Renews Climate Justice Coalition. And we invited her on because she's also a member of the New York State Climate Action Council, the 22-member council that was set up by the new climate law, CLCPA, a couple of years ago to sort of guide New York State in developing a plan for climate action. So, Rye, do you want to give us sort of a brief introduction as to, you know, why you are a member of the State Climate Action Council?
Sure. Thank you so much for that introduction. Thank you to everybody listening. I'm always happy to talk about the leadership that New York State is taking on climate action and my role in it. So yes, I am very pleased and honored to be a member of the New York State Climate Action Council as an appointee. I was appointed by Leader Andrea Stewart Cousins pursuant to the CLCPA, which requires in the statute that there be a certain number of appointees from the governor, a certain number from other folks. So that is how I landed up there. And I also like to think that it's also because of my extensive background as an energy and environmental attorney. I've been doing this work for several years in private practice and with advocacy organizations. A lot of experience in advocating for renewable energy policy, grid innovation, as well as a focus on justice. I wrote a book called Energy Justice that was released in 2018. So my focus on the Climate Action Council is really how can we meet our climate goals in a just and equitable way with a real focus on women, children, families, businesses. What is this going to mean for all of us in our everyday lives?
I guess one of the main charges of the council is to develop a climate action plan to help guide the state on its future climate activities. I believe by the next governor's term, 2023, is supposed to be in place. How is that process going at the moment? How can people participate in it? And how binding actually is the plan? Is it more like law, or is it more like, you know, recommendations to the state government?
That's a great question. I really encourage folks to get involved. Hopefully there's some links that I can share afterwards, but you can go on the website. You can sign up for updates. And all of the meetings of the Climate Action Council are public, as are the meetings of most of the meetings of the advisory body. So, and there's so many things to be interested in, be it power generation, energy efficiency, agriculture, waste. If you have an interest in this area, you can literally just join us virtually, peep in, take a look at what we're doing. I truly encourage everyone to do that because this has to be a public engagement process if we're actually going to have a meaningful transition to clean energy and carbon reduction throughout our entire economy. And yes, this Climate Action Council intervention is more than a let's write a plan and put it on the shelf. Per the statute, the plan will be presented to the governor and the legislature and turned into regulation. So this is an intervention that is intended for the public and other stakeholders to have an opportunity to shape how we get to our goals.
Now, we asked you to come on today to speak, you know, as a member of the Climate Action Council and not per se as a staff person for New York Renews. But I know that New York Renews and others have recently put out in a report concerning what they view as some of the false solutions that at least the Cuomo administration seem to be embracing, such as promotion of renewable gas and various sort of carbon capture, biomass type of things. You know, how does the, you know, council grapple when that type of report is presented, because the governor has, you know, largely 13 of the votes, and then the other, you know, 9 votes are divided among a couple of environmentalists, a couple of, you know, climate scientists, a couple of fossil fuel people, and a couple of renewable energy. How have they, respond to some of the pushback from some climate activists that some of these ideas being presented really doesn't meet what we would view as a clean, renewable energy scenario?
Look, this is my position, is that the state must follow the law, the letter of the law of the CLCPA, which is now law and demands that we get to 70% renewable energy by 2030 and 100% by 2040. And things that, like, quote unquote, renewable natural gas, in my view, do not meet the letter of the law in terms of what is clean energy. It should not surprise anyone that industries that are deeply invested in fossil fuels are existentially upset and worried about these new goals, and that are going to characterize the same type of old solutions as innovation, new investments, things that are necessary for reliability, things that are necessary to keep costs down. Those narratives aren't true. And we're going to push to make sure that our state follows the law.
Now, I will quickly mention that the goals you articulated, like the goal 100% renewable energy by 2040, that's for the electricity sector. Right. And not for other necessarily transportation or buildings. What do you see as some of the greatest challenges the state will have and meet in, it's fairly ambitious goals for climate action?
There are a lot of challenges. And I will emphasize that tackling these challenges, as James Baldwin says, that not every, we're about to get a James Baldwin quote wrong. This is not good. Not every problem can be, not every obstacle can be overcome, but you can overcome it until you face it. And not only are we facing these issues that are, the world needs to solve by tackling this plan, but their advantages of doing so far outweigh the benefits of putting our heads in the sand for a number of reasons. One, we taking leadership means we are getting ready for a transformation that's going to be led now from the federal government and also internationally. We are getting ready for a transformation that is going to benefit our economy. It's going to benefit our people, our businesses. And because of the CLCPA, we're going to do it in a way that focuses on equity and justice and doesn't leave folks behind. The benefits of tackling the problems far outweigh the dangers of not only not getting ready, but ignoring climate crisis and ending up with terrible situations like the utilities in, say, California and Texas are facing.
In some ways, one of the major accomplishments of the CLCPA, and I would also say a major accomplishment of New York Renews, was really elevating the concept that 40% of climate funding should be dedicated to the communities that have been most negatively impacted. That was unfortunately tweaked a little bit by the governor before it was passed, but even President Biden has now sort of adopted it. Here in the Capital District, like happened in New York City with Sunset Park, we just got $200 million to invest in the Port of Albany for wind towers. If you're trying to get 35 to 40% of that $200 million, $70, $80 million to go to what's called disadvantaged communities, what guidance or decisions has the CAC been able to make yet? How does that actually translate? How do you define what is a benefit and how do you define what is a disadvantaged community?
So what is very important is that the statute, again, put a big piece of developing that exact criteria, who is a disadvantaged community and what is benefit, in the hands of a climate justice working group. That working group is made up of environmental justice leaders, others, and again, designed so that there is a way for stakeholder input in some of these crucial definitions. So Climate Justice Working Group is plugging along. We expect some recommendations to come out from them this year. And until then, the state is, I think, really doing what we're beginning to do and what I know I and others have been urging them to do is to get their arms around this exact question, because there are answers to how to get your arms around it. What we really need to do is start getting their arms around how have we been doing the spending before? How have we been looking at quote unquote disadvantaged communities. And I think a lot of it has fallen under the bucket of LMI, low and moderate income customers. And I think that is a starting place, but it is insufficient. And so the state is starting to grapple with it. We are encouraging and pushing it.
Raya, unfortunately, we're out of time. We've been talking with Raya Salter, New York State Climate Action Council, New York Renews. You have a website.
And my website is www.ryasalter.com.
And this has been Mark Dunley for the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network.
On March 22nd, there was a rally in downtown Albany to draw attention to the racism that the Asian American community is facing called Stop Asian Hate. It was reported in the Times Union that more than 300 people attended this event. With us now is one of the organizers from this event, Gina Kim, the owner of Sun He's Restaurant in downtown Troy.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming back and taking the time to speak with us again.
Oh, absolutely. My pleasure.
It was certainly a highly emotional evening, and there was so much to unpack and so many different speakers and so much going on. I got a chance to talk to you kind of at the very beginning of the event before Sure. things had kind of kicked off. And I know you had like really great energy, and you had really great energy the whole night. I was kind of curious if you were able to maintain that for the entirety of the night.
Definitely. It was high strung, lots going on. And I think things that happened not exactly according to the agenda, which I also understand. I think all in all, I've been thinking a lot about it, even in the past, 24 hours at this point. And I'm thrilled with the success of the event, which I think was extremely successful just in terms of even turnout within a couple of days. The wide variety of the types of people, the representation from all sorts of ethnic backgrounds, cultures, communities, races. It was really amazing because in the capital region, we've never really seen that kind of presence in a single moment in time where we were all rallied together with a unified voice. I think it was clear, like even in the planning of things, there were some disagreements from different generations of how things should play out. Like with any type of organizing, you have a variety of different perspectives and philosophies and experiences. And I think for us, it was even more of a challenge as newer immigrant generations, right? Like a race that is we still have first generation immigrants here. So even like myself, I'll struggle with those like cultural, like something like a lot of us who were born here don't even speak the language that our parents speak. So there's a language barrier, there's the cultural barrier. And so those were things that we really had to reconcile throughout this process, and which we are continuing to do and trying to learn. And my hopes are that we are able to do that and still have a unified voice.
Yeah, it was really great. There was, like you said, so many different voices, and this idea of like of race not being a monolith is something that I feel like has been spoken at rallies throughout the last year, really specifically at Black Lives Matter rallies, and something that I really kind of latch onto and amplify. And so many different voices. One of the things that I felt like I noticed that was really interesting compared to other rallies that I've been to in the last year was this sense of, and maybe you noticed as well. I'm curious how your thoughts were. Going from a place where it seemed like an audience, the crowd itself had so much to say, and then kind of filtering that through a couple of really strong speakers to then voice what the crowd had to say to essentially the assemblymen or maybe the politicians that were then the ears. This kind of seemed almost the opposite, where it's like the whole crowd was there really to listen from what I was to hearing, and then it seemed to be a mixed bag of who was there to speak or who was going to be allowed to have the time to speak there. And some maybe just a kind of essence of time trying to figure out who, was more important to speak or to be heard in that moment. What were your feelings about that as that kind of played out through the night?
Yeah, I mean, sure. As an organizer of any event, you understand that you have the attention of your audience for a limited amount of time. You know, they say 30 to 45 minutes at the most. I think I come from like a Korean church background. Like, I've heard sermons that go for hours. So it's very different. But for us, we knew that, yeah, time was of the essence. We felt like at least the portion that I was in charge of was really organizing and mobilizing the community members who were speaking and sharing their stories. We unfortunately had to kind of push one our final speaker to the end. But I do think it was a blessing in disguise, because it really did empower us to speak even more. And it was, Jeanette Lamb, she spoke and really emphasized that and ended on that note of how collectivism and the collectivization of people, of communities of color, is really going to be our weapon and our mobilization and our force, really. And so I'm like ultimately like happy how it happened, but then at the same time, there's a lot of thoughts where I know, there were a lot of former like first generation immigrants there who actually. They told me afterwards that they were like, wow, I was really happy to hear the politicians tell me that, you know, they care about this issue. So I think in our our differing cultures, they do have the sense of like honor and respect. And I think there are times that can be a pro and a con. I highly respect our previous generations, which is why when it comes to things like showing respect for elders and authority figures, like I get it and I get where they're coming from. You know, when they first came to this country, being associated with whiteness was their ticket to survival and just making it and safety in this community, in our communities. And so in that sense, I feel like we were able to catch all of that and yet bring it back around and be like, hey, this is about our voice. Like the women who were killed, six out of eight of them in Georgia, they were Asian women. And so I felt very strongly about the presence and the showing of those faces and those voices in a very real manner. And I think we did the right thing of calling people out and asking them to follow up those speeches and their presence and then being there with actual tangible action to partner with us. But I think for me, what I'm trying to do and really think about even as we move forward is how can we continue to collect these stories and really create a platform for voices that have both culturally and traditionally been oppressed for generations and for a very long time. And Asian Americans, like, you know, I love the sign that people are holding, like, I am not a model minority, you know, rejecting the stereotypes, but also, you know, sometimes just being who we are, not having to either fight against or be with the stereotype, you know, so not letting that define us. And I think we saw that. We saw like the essence of that last night.
I agree. It was really, really powerful. To see in action. And I agree. It was for me, like listening to it and taking it all in the crowd right there in the front, there was some of it that I could feel wasn't for me or didn't really kind of sit with me or felt somewhat like political theater or felt something like maybe with some falsified action there. But looking around me, I could tell that there was certainly people of different generations that very much worked for. It certainly gave me pause to kind of sit back and think about what was the most effective thing to be heard. And I do think that there was a mixed bag of all of that for everybody last night. What do you feel like as far as going forward with the organization? I know you run a restaurant. I know you have many hats that you're doing. Is this in the events of last night just encouraging to do more organization and to dive further into that yourself?
Sure. Yeah, you know, last night I said it myself. I never really considered myself an activist. And even now I'm like, ooh, like activist is kind of a strong word for me. But I think I just found such a burden especially in light of everything that was happening to again, use our business and our restaurant that has been here as a platform for, as that, not just a spokesperson, but really a voice piece that can amplify Asian American women and I think younger generations in particular. So I think what we're going to really work on is collecting again, having a coalition of those voices, people from all sorts of backgrounds, ethnic backgrounds, languages, and even generations, hopefully, because you do have younger first generation Asian Americans. But using education, our restaurant is all about education, whether it's.
Stop, children, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down.
This is Marina Abramović, and you're listening to WGXC 90.7 FM Accra Creative Community Radio.
Beautiful.
Have a good day.
The EBFN.
Block it.
Evidence-Based Fiction Network Radio.
Street stop. Block it. Muscle guy. Speed car. Cop car. Shotgun. Cop car. Noise ordinance. Hot night. Drive it. Run it. Knock, knock.
It's EBFN, the Evidence-Based Fiction Network Radio. Sundays at 3:30 on Wave Farm Radio for open ears. WGXC, Accra, 90.7 FM.
WGXC, 90.7 FM, Accra.
WGXC is made possible in part by the generous ongoing support of Igers Kildas and Louisa Sabin Kildas of Hudson, New York. Sustaining supporters are among the station's most dedicated listeners. They care deeply about Creative Community Radio, and their investment helps to sustain WGXC as a public platform for information, experimentation, and engagement in Greene and Columbia counties. You too can become a WGXC sustaining supporter by investing in community radio every month. Go to WGXC.org and click donate. Thank you for your support.
This is Brian DeWan. I leave my clock radio tuned to 90.7 FM so that when it goes off in the morning, the first thing I hear is WGXC.
Ban assault weapons now. I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! With Dennis Moynihan and our weekly Breaking the Sound Barrier podcast. The massacres in Boulder, Colorado, with 10 killed, and in Metro Atlanta, with 8 dead, are just two more instances of senseless gun violence enabled by the National Rifle Association, gun manufacturers, and the corrupt politicians they control. Here is a short reminder of some others for any who might need it. Columbine High School, Colorado, 1999, 15 dead, 24 injured. Virginia Tech, 2007, 33 dead, 17 injured. The Aurora Theater, Colorado, 2012, 12 dead, 70 injured. Oak Creek, Wisconsin, Sick Temple, 2012, 7 dead, 4 injured. Sandy Hook Elementary School, Connecticut, 2012, 28 dead, 2 injured. Charleston, South Carolina, Emmanuel AME Church, 2015, 9 dead, 1 injured. Orlando's Pulse Nightclub, Florida, 2016, 50 dead, 53 injured. Las Vegas, Nevada, 2017, 61 dead, 411 injured. Parkland, Florida High School, 2018, 17 dead, 17 injured. El Paso, Walmart, Texas, 2019, 23 dead, 23 injured. Dayton, Ohio, 2019, 10 dead, 27 injured. These are just some of the notorious massacres, each surrounded in time by countless others, with 3, 4, 5 killed, lives lost in acts of violence that lack the body count sufficient to join the canon of American mass shootings. This carnage was wrought with powerful semi-automatic firearms, almost all of which were assault weapons. This is why we need a federal assault weapons ban now.
Assault rifles, I mean, that's all that does is put the mass into shootings.
That's Democratic Colorado State Representative Tom Sullivan speaking on the Democracy Now! NewsHour shortly after the Boulder grocery store massacre this week.
Here in Colorado in 2013, we actually passed 5 common sense of gun violence prevention bills. We passed the background check bill. We passed limiting high capacity magazines. We passed making people pay for their background checks, doing things about domestic violence, doing things about making people actually show up in front of somebody to get a concealed carry permit. But if you want to drive 20 minutes and go into Wyoming, you can buy whatever it is you want and come back down. That's why it is imperative that we get the federal government to partner with us.
Tom Sullivan's route to gun control and elected office was difficult. His son Alex was killed in the Aurora Theater massacre celebrating his 27th birthday. When politicians subsequently ignored Sullivan's pleas for common sense gun control, he ran for office himself. He lost, then won, in a district that had been held by Republicans for decades. In the wake of the 2018 Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School massacre in Parkland, Florida, and absent national legislation to address recurring mass shootings, the Boulder City Council passed ordinances banning the sale and possession of assault weapons and extended ammunition magazines. Just days before this week's massacre in Boulder, a state judge declared the ordinances illegal, legalizing possession of the very weapon used in the Boulder slaughter. Now the Democratic-controlled Colorado State Legislature, with the support of Democratic Governor Jared Polis, himself a longtime Boulder resident who said he'd shot many times at the King Super supermarket where the massacre occurred, is considering a statewide assault weapons ban. Within hours of the Boulder massacre, while the victims' bodies were still on the supermarket floor, Republican Colorado Congresswoman Lauren Boebert, whose defense of unlimited gun rights borders on maniacal. At her restaurant in Rifle, Colorado, called Shooter's Grill, she encourages her staff to carry guns while working, sent out a fundraising email declaring hell no to gun control. The NRA responded to the massacre by tweeting the text of the Second Amendment. Meanwhile, the federal Ninth District Court of Appeals ruled Tuesday that state laws prohibiting open carry of firearms are constitutional. Its 215-page order detailing the history of gun regulation in colonial America and the development of the Second Amendment should be required reading. Quote, "The Second Amendment does not guarantee an unfettered general right to openly carry arms in public for individual self-defense," the court concluded. In Washington, D.C., President Joe Biden says he supports a national assault weapons ban. But with the razor-thin Democratic majority in the Senate, passage of gun control would depend on the support of pro-gun Democratic West Virginia Senator Joe Manchin, as well as a decision by the entire Senate Democratic caucus, including Manchin and conservative Democratic Arizona Senator Kyrsten Sinema, to eliminate or alter the filibuster. Gun control legislation will have to navigate a narrow path to become law. In the United States, Tom Sullivan concluded,
100 people die every day from gun violence. 22 of those are veterans who are dying by suicide. But also over 200 people are injured by accidental shootings. A lot of those are children.
No legislation will bring back his son, Alex, nor any of the millions killed by gun violence in the United States over the decades. But we can prevent future violence with a national enforceable ban on these weapons of war. I'm Amy Goodman with Dennis Moynihan.
German measles, Russian flu, Montezuma's revenge. And why do we say a foreign word whenever someone sneezes?
Tomorrow, I'll take a look at swine flu, up close and personal. This is Les Nesbitt.
Your forecast for the weekend. Well, on Saturday, sunny with a high near 58 degrees. It will be partly cloudy Saturday night with a temperature low of around 41. And on Sunday, showers mainly after 7 a.m. with a temperature high near 56 degrees. And Sunday night, a chance of showers before 2 a.m. It will be mostly cloudy with a temperature low of around 36 degrees. And that is your weather update from WGXC 90.7 FM, radio for open ears in Greene and Columbia counties.
One speeding ticket, Columbia County.
Columbia County, everybody gets speeding tickets. How else do they pay for the roads to get plowed in the winter?
One day, Hadida Naharam was wandering around the countryside swinging his axe, looking for likely trees to cut down. First out of the tree. While he was still dazed, she trussed him and slid him into a sack, which she tied up and slung over her shoulder as though it had no weight. Then she began to walk, taking powerful long strides. By this time, Khalid and Haram knew he had been captured by a ruler. Without any hesitation, she sat down and began to devour the raw flesh. But then, as she ate, she pushed her hand down into the mass and pulled out a breast. She stared at it a moment, put her head back, and shrieked in lament. She did as he told her, and he hurled the poker down into her mouth. It was so hot that the end of it came out through her neck. She rolled around on the floor, bumping into things. "What's wrong, grandmother? Did you fall?" She peered up at him, and he emptied the burning coals over her eyes and face. She rolled on the floor again, and at that point, Hadid and Haram ran down the ladder, his axe in his hand. He swung at her neck, and chopped at it until her head fell off.
Yeah. E-F-F-E-C-T. I'm Nikolai Jr.
We live in an age of explosive increase of knowledge.
We don't want them like savages.
That was Hedara, part one zombie killers and part two base zombies.
Pensar assim, se eu sou muito louco por eu ser feliz, mas louco é quem me diz e não é feliz. Eles são bonitos, sou Alain Delon. Se eles são famosos, sou Napoleão. Mais louco é quem me diz e não é feliz. Rezam muito, já estou no céu mais louco. É quem me diz que não é feliz. Não é feliz. Eu juro que é. Sou